Welcome to Talk Nation Radio as we continue our special series on accountability for the U.S. and Israel, as we turn now to the intelligence world. First, the crimes of the CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, created by the offices that fought the Nazis during the Second World War. Secretly, toward the end of that war, the OSS and then CIA began working with some of the world's most unsavory people, including Nazis, helping thousands of Nazi leaders escape prosecution and even incorporating the kinds of military experimentation these Nazis might have used into secret U.S. operations.
Between 500 and 600 people, basically, as a result of the experiment, went stark raving mad for a day, and four committed suicide.
We'll look at a decades-long history of complete impunity for the CIA's crimes as they gave people LSD secretly, including U.S. military personnel and patients in mental hospitals, even children under the age of 10 in New England. As we consider how a lack of prosecution for these early CIA crimes helped lead the Bush-Cheney administration down a similar path as they institutionalized policies like torture and rendition and authorized the CIA to work domestically in the United States. H.P. Albarelli Jr. joins us to talk about his 2009 book, A Terrible Mistake, The Murder of Frank Olson and the CIA's Cold War Experiments. An investigative reporter and writer for over 20 years, H.P., or Hank Albarelli, has worked at the Carter White House and for the U.S. Treasury Department. He had been doing articles on biological warfare and intelligence when he stumbled across documents about a case dating back to CIA and Army projects of the 1950s, known as MKUltra, Artichoke, and Bluebird. He had reasons to believe then that the suicide of former Army Special Operations Division official Frank Olson was really a murder. Olson phoned his wife not long before his death, saying in a strange voice, "I've made a terrible mistake." Not long before, Olson had been secretly dosed with LSD. We asked Hank Albarelli why this old CIA history began to interest him so much.
Like everybody, I can recall the exposures of the mid-70s, 1975, 76, and 77, when all the LSD stuff was splashed across the front pages of the Washington Post and the New York Times, and including the Olson case. I remember specifically reading that article and thinking it was pretty incredible, and then, like most Americans, probably forgot about it within a week or two. But then I relocated from Washington, D.C. to Catonsville, Maryland, and through a series of events there, I became aware of the fact that a state mental hospital in Catonsville, Maryland, it's commonly called Spring Grove, but formerly called the Maryland Psychiatric Institute, had been used in the early 50s for a lot of covert experiments and private experiments. And there was probably a lot of crossover between the two. And I started looking into that just out of curiosity. It had nothing to do with the Olson case, but I managed to visit the facility a couple times, and a grounds person let me into a storage room where a lot of the old logs were kept for visitors to the facility. And I went through, I was especially interested in the early 50s because I knew that's when the experiments had started. And in looking at one of the logs, I came across a few names that were familiar from the newspapers, including Frank Olson's name. And he had visited Spring Grove on the same day that another man who worked with him and Dr. Harold Abramson had visited. Abramson, you may recall, was the physician that Olson was ultimately taken to the week of his death in New York. I think it was late 1950 when they initially visited there. So that piqued my curiosity about the Olson case, too, but I didn't do much about it until maybe 3 or 4 weeks later. There was a news article on the front page of the Metro section of the Washington Post concerning Frank Olson's body being brought up out of the grave to be reburied, but the remaining of the Olson family decided they also wanted a forensic investigation conducted into his death because there had always been doubts about his alleged suicide. So that piqued my interest in the Olson case, and I searched around for something well written on the case, and besides just newspaper articles, which were pretty sketchy, the only thing I could find was John Marks's book, The Search for the Manchurian Candidate, which had what appeared to be a really good chapter on the Olson case in the book. But after I read that chapter a couple of times, there were just numerous things in it that made no sense to me. I talked to Marks, and he was convinced that Olson had committed suicide and there was nothing else to it. But I wasn't. There were too many strange things about just the death itself that bothered me. And after about a year, I started really digging into it. Initially, I was thinking about writing an article, but I realized within 2 or 3 months that the article would have been way overly long. I had too much information and not enough to counter any of the things that were bothering me. So I knew it was a book. I didn't know at that point in time how big it was going to be, though, and that it was going to take a little over 10 years.
What about Frank Olson as the expert at aerosol delivery systems for biological weapons? Talk about Fort Detrick, what you learned about Olson in that respect, and sure, when you learned that, because that turned out to be very important.
I knew right from the start that Olson worked at Fort Detrick, or Camp Detrick, as it was called at the time that he was there. And I think according to Marx's book, Marx wrote that Olson was an expert in anthrax and the aerosol delivery of anthrax, but I found out that that was not true. Olson had little to nothing to do with anthrax. Olson was a laboratory worker initially at Fort Detrick, but not while they were working on anthrax. And when the Special Operations Division was created at Detrick, Olson transferred over to that in early 1950, and he was basically an administrator, but his specialty was protective clothing and protective gear that was used around experiments. And he was also always, when he was with SOD, at an administrator's level. For a little over a year, he was actually the director of the Special Operations Division. So he wasn't a workbench researcher, and I was able to come up with some records concerning experiments that had been conducted that Olson had been engaged in domestically. There was one in San Francisco, and it was clear that his job on that experiment was, again, protective clothing and making sure that everyone involved in it had the proper protections from whatever chemicals that were being handled.
We read in your book that witnesses testifying about MKUltra, Operation Bluebird, and other of these secret programs involving LSD and other chemicals, that there was discussion very openly, very matter-of-factly, about aerosolizing LSD in a weaponized form and using it in bombs and using it against militaries, and how, you know, that would be so-called humane warfare.
Right. Right. That was actually first proposed by the research director at Edgewood Arsenal, a man called L. Wilson Green, Luther Wilson Green. And when he first proposed that, it was 1949. And the Army seemed to be very much attracted to LSD as possibly a way to not fight violent warfare. It seems, in retrospect, and even then, it seemed rather ludicrous that they thought that. I assume they didn't know a whole lot about the drug, and I would guess, there's no reports to this effect, that they found out rather quickly that LSD wasn't good for warfare, but it wasn't until they conducted a number of experiments, both domestically and in Europe, that they were able to discover that. And then the emphasis, the use of LSD, evolved rather quickly into a technique for interrogations or just simple torture, or to surreptitiously dose someone to put them off balance or to embarrass them.
There was an instance that you covered of a U.S. soldier dosed, and he happened to be African-American. Can you tell us about that case?
James A. Thornwell. Yeah, that's a pretty sad case. He was actually a soldier in Europe that, I think it was in France, as a matter of fact, that was suspected of, well, it was kind of vague, either stealing or passing documents on, and some of the documents may have had something to do with experiments that had been conducted in the 50s in France, It's a good example of LSD and interrogation. He wasn't confined to his quarters and dosed with LSD intentionally as part of an ongoing interrogation. And it went on for a good number of days and did some severe damage to him. And Thornley, as a result of that, actually had an epileptic fit while he was in a swimming pool one day and drowned. But his case was interesting because it actually happened, I think, in the mid-70s. Or right before the Olson exposures, and during a time when everybody was under the impression that LSD use and interrogations had tapered off, but it hadn't. And indeed, it's still used today by the Army and the other services in interrogation settings. It's been used at Guantanamo. It's been used domestically with the young fellow from Chicago that was arrested right after 9/11, Jose Padilla, who's now in federal prison for the rest of his life. According to his lawyers, he was given LSD between 2 and 4 times.
Well, the key to this, of course, may be that it was finally, ultimately, the LSD that caused the soldier, Thornwell, to confess.
Exactly, because he couldn't take it anymore. He'd had no exposure to the drug prior to that. And giving somebody LSD and a strong amount, as he was given, I think it was 150 or 170 mics, can be a terrifying experience for somebody who's in a negative situation to begin with. It can be absolutely terrifying and mind-damaging in numerous ways.
Talk about these two medical doctors that were in Olson's life at the time of his death, Dr. Sidney Gottlieb and Dr. Robert Lashbrook.
Lashbrook was with Olson the night he died. He was actually in the room the night Olson was murdered. He claimed to have been sleeping. And after Olson went out the window, Lashbrook actually telephoned Gottlieb in Washington. But Lashbrook, the assistant director of the chemical division at the CIA in Washington, was in the room and had gone to New York a week earlier with a one-day break returning to Washington with Olson to actually do some damage assessment on Olson. Olson was preparing to leave his employment with Fort Detrick and the CIA and had become fairly indiscreet about the way he talked about things. And the agency and the Army became very, very concerned about his being indiscreet. And he was a hard person to deal with to begin with, which I was surprised to learn. And he was a tough personality to deal with. When I initially read the Marx book and then talked to a few other people, Olson came across, I think it actually says this in the Marx book, as a real fun-loving guy, practical joker that everyone liked and enjoyed being around because he was always funny and humorous. But when I really dug into Olson's personality, I found out just the opposite. A lot of people didn't like him at all because they perceived him to be fairly arrogant. He had a real problem with authority, which wasn't a good trait to have when you're working on a top-secret military base. And there were a lot of altercations with Olson and various military people in terms of his entering and leaving the base. He didn't like to show proper credentials. And then on top of that, he was an anti-Semite, and that created a lot of problems for him, especially with people like Gottlieb and Abramson. And I wasn't sure how bad an anti-Semite he was until I interviewed his brother-in-law, a well-known social science professor in the country. And he told me he knew Frank. He was married to Alice, Frank's wife's sister, and he explained that Frank was so bad when Jewish people were around that he would actually leave. He said it was just horribly embarrassing and he couldn't take it. Initially, that threw me for a loop because there were so many people that Olson was working with that were Jewish, and according to his brother-in-law, he didn't tolerate Jewish people well at all and would go out of his way to offend them and to create embarrassing situations. I talked to Gottlieb about it. I interviewed Gottlieb a few times before he died, and I specifically brought it up with Gottlieb, and Gottlieb said he wasn't aware of it, and he always found Olson to be enjoyable to be around, and he always had good discussions with him, but I'm sure that was scripted.
You suggest, though, in your epilogue, that Frank Olson was also haunted to death by the nightmarish images of Pensée-Nesprit, France. Now, what happened there? Because I believe you were suggesting there was an experiment going on?
The government conducted, specifically the Special Operations Division at Fort Detrick, with Olson participating, and the CIA in August of 1951 conducted an experiment in this small town in southern France called Pensée-Nesprit with LSD. And the experiment was pretty horrifying. It affected, the numbers are vague, but between 500 and 600 people, basically, as a result of the experiment, went stark raving mad for a day, and four committed suicide, and between 30 and 40 were carted off for extensive periods of time to mental institutions. When Olson became very indiscreet in the final few months of his life, that was one of the experiments he talked about, and that triggered a high level of concern on the part of both the agency and the army. They didn't want that known at all. It's been said by others that Olson was threatening to go to the newspapers with that story, but I found no evidence of that whatsoever. And frankly, I think if he had gone to the newspapers, they probably would have turned him in, because in 1953, the newspapers weren't prone to do that kind of investigating reporting towards the CIA. They really would have considered it their patriotic duty to turn Olson in. But Olson, nonetheless, did speak to some other people, mainly colleagues who weren't privy to the experiment, who did turn him in. And that eventually, within a few months, led to his murder.
Murder, or were they trying to do to him what they did to the U.S. soldier to find out exactly who he told?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, they did do to him what they did to Thornley. They did it 9 days before his death at a secret meeting that between the Army and the CIA that was held in Deep Creek Lake, Maryland. That's a remote rural part of Maryland, and there was a rendezvous there with a number of people from Fort Detrick, including Olson and his superior, and Sidney Gottlieb and Robert Lashbrook and a couple other people from the agency. And Olson, at that gathering, was dosed with LSD and initially interrogated. And it was as a result of that interrogation, which came as a complete surprise to Olson, that 9 days later he was sent to New York for further damage assessment. And on the night that he died, he actually was trying to flee the room. And one of the reasons he was trying to flee the room is it had been determined earlier that day that he was, once he left New York, was going to be taken to a mental facility in Rockville, Maryland, that was called Chestnut Lodge, where it was a facility that the CIA very much favored use of for their own employees in the early 50s. And Olson, the decision had been made in New York to bring Olson back to Rockville, Maryland, and confine him in Chestnut Lodge, where it's my opinion he probably would have never come out of that experience alive. I mean, he was murdered in New York, but it was only because he tried to flee the hotel he was in, and there was a violent struggle that ensued with the two foreign nationals who had been charged with removing him from the room and taking him back to Rockville, Maryland. They didn't want him on an airplane the next day because days earlier he had tried to escape, and he was also begging to be allowed to disappear. He knew his number was up, and he was desperately trying to get away from his CIA and Army handlers.
Let's turn to, again, Gottlieb. I want to look at the testimony he gave in 1977. Where he very, very calmly admits the CIA arranged this operation of covertly administering chemical materials to unwitting people. Mm-hmm. LSD and Meritran?
Yeah, it was common to give those to unwitting subjects, and that was given to Olson also. According to Gottlieb, he used it mixed in with LSD because he thought it intensified the experience, but at the same time smoothed it out a little bit. And usually towards the end, you become withdrawn and tired and sometimes depressed. So that drug may have acted to smooth out the letdown towards the end. In the 60s and 70s, it was common for physicians to give college students who were tripping on LSD Thorazine to help them come down from the experience. But in my research, I found that it was just as effective mainly to maybe give someone, you know, some hot milk and just talk them slowly down. I don't think it was really necessary to give them yet another drug on top of everything. But some people react very differently to LSD. And most people generally have a good experience on it if they know they're getting the drug and it's been explained to them what's going to happen. It's a completely different situation when somebody's unwittingly given the drug. Because your first reaction, and it's a normal reaction, is that I'm going crazy. That I don't know why, but something's happening and I'm going crazy.
And of course, people wouldn't know when it was going to end either.
No, they'd have no clue. And after it would go on for, well, a half hour, much less 3 or 4 hours, it would be horribly frightening. And that's why in Pont-Saint-Esprit and in other situations, people unwittingly given the drug would commit suicide because they thought they just weren't going to return to a normal state.
Returning to Sidney Gottlieb, he too in 1977 admits that not only did they covertly administer this chemical to unwitting people, no protections were given to the subjects. And here's a quote. Where national security was concerned, such a procedure and such a risk was reasonable to take.
Yeah, that's kind of hard to swallow. There's a lot of hypocrisy in that because Gottlieb, it's also in another section of the book, Gottlieb took the drug himself. Gottlieb actually liked LSD and took it over 30 times himself and told me that every time he took it, it was beneficial to him. But what Gottlieb didn't explain when he said that before Congress and when he touted the drug in other situations was that the first few times he took the drug was with physicians present, a number of physicians who had also taken the drug prior and who were able to guide him through the experience. And then after that, it's fairly easy to take it alone because you know what to expect. But Gottlieb should have known better. When you're giving it to countless people, soldiers, people off the street in an unwitting situation is just completely different. And he well knew that. Gottlieb in the 70s, it's interesting what happened to him. There was a decision made, and some of this I've found out subsequent to publishing the book. There was a decision made in the mid-70s when Olson's dosing with LSD was exposed through the Ford White House, through the Rockefeller Commission. But there was a decision made by the CIA and the White House that concerted efforts be made to draw the public's attention towards MKUltra. And they wanted people to focus on MKUltra as opposed to the project that Olson worked on, which was Project Artichoke. And the reason they wanted that simply was because MKUltra, they knew, was going to be exposed anyway. But that was the lesser of the two programs in terms of horrible things done. And MKUltra essentially, even though a lot of experiments were conducted under MKUltra, MKUltra was essentially a research program that had the effect of the CIA issuing about 150 subcontracts to colleges, universities, and research institutions all across the country, and it was actually those institutions and consultants that conducted the experiments we all know about today. But they didn't want people to focus on Project Artichoke because Artichoke was the operational arm of MKUltra, and all of the data and technology that looked very, very useful from MKUltra was actually put to practice operationally through Artichoke, both domestically and in Europe and in other countries. And they didn't want people to focus on that. And so the general counsel at the CIA, Lawrence Houston, actually had a couple meetings with Donald Rumsfeld and Richard Cheney, who were working in the Ford White House at that point in time, to manipulate both the media and the public away from Artichoke and towards MKUltra. And you can look back historically and see how effective that effort was, because even if you go on the internet and Google the two programs, you'll find hundreds, if not thousands, of references to the fact that MKUltra replaced the Artichoke program. And that's simply not true. They ran parallel to one another, and actually Artichoke ran for a longer period of time than MKUltra. But again, they wanted to draw people's attention away from Artichoke because it would lead people towards more information about what Olson had actually been doing, because Olson, during his last 3 years at Fort Detrick, had been a formal member of what the CIA called the Artichoke Committee, or it's more often called the Artichoke Conference. And that was basically the steering committee, the policy committee that passed on approval or disapproval of field experiments that would be conducted operationally by the CIA. And there were just a lot of horrible things that were done under Artichoke, and there were a lot of deaths overseas. A lot of foreign nationals were killed because of that program. And eventually Artichoke actually developed an arm that was focused on assassination. It was a multi-purpose program. It was experimental. It was aimed at interrogation. It was aimed at mind control, and they developed the means to control people to the extent that they'd go against their principles or moral beliefs and do everything, including kill others.
Well, there is a document in your book where former Vice President Cheney, then an advisor to White House Chief of Staff Donald Rumsfeld, says, you know, apologize. He's describing exactly what should be said to contain this.
Right.
How much did he know?
There's actually, if you go to my website, all of those documents, and there's about 30 or 40 of them. It appears to me that Cheney and Rumsfeld probably knew everything and had been briefed by the CIA. I don't think they certainly didn't know it at the time, because they were pretty young when Olson was murdered. But I think in 1975, when the entire incident was raised through the Rockefeller Commission report, they found out pretty quickly that Olson had been murdered. And there's one document, a White House document, that actually points to that. It was the cover sheet to a Fuller report that Cheney and Rumsfeld had seen. Unfortunately, we don't have that report, and I assume that was destroyed, or the CIA says it doesn't exist and never existed, but that kind of defies the fact that there is a cover sheet to it. And that cover sheet actually mentions or lists the names of both of Olson's killers, who were both French nationals, and it gives an identity number to each, and also gives an identity number to Pont Saint-Esprit. So obviously somebody had briefed Cheney and Rumsfeld as to what had really happened.
H.P. Albarelli is author of the acclaimed 2009 book, A Terrible Mistake, The Murder of Frank Olson and the CIA's Secret Cold War Experiments. In it, he documents the evidence about MKUltra, Artichoke, Bluebird, and other secret operations, and reviews failed attempts at accountability. You can learn more at www.aterriblemistake.com. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated nationally with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts and audio. Next time, more on the CIA's secret operations, contractors, and the impact of Artichoke and Bluebird on America's past, present, and future.